Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who has both casual and formal golf shoes, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at CLT underscore golf guy. Well, this week is the calm before the storm that is the United States Open Championship. Although I wouldn't exactly call the FedEx St. Jude in Memphis at TPC Southwind calm. In fact, if I was a player that liked to play the week before a major, I think I'd make an exception this week. That course is long. It's tough. Temperatures are hot. Basically, it's a grind. And next week is going to be enough of that to last anyone, in my opinion. Today on the show, we talk with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer about last week's Memorial, next week at Shinnecock, and where we are this week. But we begin today with the first of a two-part conversation with caddy David Woosley. His man, Sam Burns, was the medalist by five shots this week at the U.S. Open qualifying sectional in Memphis and will be in the field next week. We'll deal with that later. You see, in 1986, the United States Open returned to Shinnecock Hills for the first time since 1896. Chip Beck finished second that year behind Raymond Floyd. The man on his bag? You guessed it, Woos. What's it like to know that you're toting the bag in a U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills just, I don't know, 32 years since the first time you did it?
I have reflected a little bit on that, and I've got great memories of that event. I think I would have had great memories anyway because it was just such a it's an amazing place, a beautiful place. But, you know, I caddied for a guy. We finished tied for second. And so, yeah, it's exciting, and I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm getting up there on Saturday. I think Sam Burns, who I'm working for, will be playing Saturday afternoon. And so we'll have plenty of time to get to know the course. And I've got a situation. I'm staying with a house with four caddy friends of mine. One of them is Pepsi Steve. A lot of people know him. So it's a good situation for me. I'm really looking forward to it.
I thought for sure you were parking your 155-foot yacht next to Tiger's there in the Hamptons, but that's not the case?
No, huh? But I have been around in that area, and it's just like it's mind-boggling how beautiful homes are. You know, it kind of doesn't compute.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. Look, when you played Shinnecock with Chip Beck in 1986, there was really no local knowledge in terms of how it would play as a championship, unless, of course, you had caddied in 1896.
Yeah.
However, this was back in the day when a U.S. Open was a U.S. Open. You had brutal rough, even and often around the greens. It was going to play long. It was going to play fast. It was going to play firm. Do you remember your first impressions of the place in practice rounds as compared to other courses? Because it really is kind of a unique place.
Yeah, I don't have like a distinct memory, but generally it seems to fall into the category where it's like, how in the heck are we going to play this golf course? You know, it's like, you know, you first look at it, and it's very intimidating, and there's a lot of work to do to get to know the course and your sight lines and stuff like that. But you know, it was exciting to be there.
Yeah, your rounds with Chip were really interesting. You go out in the first two rounds and shoot 75-73, 8 over par. The cut was 10 over, so you weren't that far from the cut line. Now, was that a, man, that was the best we could have done kind of 8 over, or was it more of a coulda, shoulda, woulda kind of 8 over?
It was probably a little bit of both, you know. All I remember is, you know, on the weekend and particularly on Sunday, Chip was playing so well. And I think that's the first time I think I've ever worked a major for a player. And at that point in time, it felt like the tournament itself was not bigger than him. In other words, he was completely present. He had everything going for him, and he was just getting after it. And so it's like you have a chance to finish really high, and there's nothing holding me back kind of thing. And so there was a lot of freedom there, and it was exciting.
Yeah, we'll get more into that Sunday here in just a second. But you brought something up about it not being bigger than him and how everything was going for him. You hear stories about pitchers who are throwing no-hitters in Major League Baseball, and people just sort of get away from them and don't say anything and sit at the end of the bench. When you're caddying for a guy who's on a roll like that, is there more conversation, less conversation? How do you handle that?
You know, there's probably less conversation, but nobody's worried about anything. You know, you're just kind of in the zone, kind of a flow type thing. And to be honest with you, I probably didn't even know, because I'd never been in a situation like that, how I would handle it. And I think I was, you know, I was just, it felt like I was, I'm not being boastful or anything, but I just felt very comfortable, and I kind of felt like I was in my element. And so I just felt kind of ready to go. And we were just, as a team, we were just very connected and, you know, kind of the world is your oyster type thing if you can just get it done.
David Woosley, Sam Burns is caddy. He's our guest taking dead aim. Caddy for Chip Beck back in the 1986 U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills, where they finished second. Saturday, you shoot 68, 2-under. Looking at the scores, it appears that Shinnecock was about as gettable as it could be. You had players like Nicklaus and Sutton and Crenshaw and Payne Stewart and Lee Trevino and your boy Beck all shooting in the 60s. Did the wind not roar as much? Were conditions more benign in the morning than the afternoon, or vice versa? Do you remember?
They were probably more benign, you know, but I don't have, like,
yeah.
I mean, all I remember is Sunday, and it was windy, and the greens were, like, so very firm, and I don't know. I was just kind of moving from one hole to the next like maybe everybody else.
Let's talk about that Sunday. You guys are paired with some guy you may have heard of named Severiano Ballesteros. This is at the height of Sevy's powers. First off, just sort of explain, how amazing was he to see play in his prime? What was it like to just watch Sevy do his thing?
This was 1990, right?
1986.
86. That's right. Okay. I'm trying to remember because, you know, like in the 89 and the 91 Ryder Cup, you know, when we were paired against him, I'm just trying to remember. So, I mean, I just didn't have a full, that could have been the first time I was paired with him, I don't know, but I know that he was like, he kind of lifted European golf on his shoulders, and he was so very confident and charismatic and cocky and all of that, and so it was kind of hard not to watch him. I certainly wasn't watching him that day, but, you know, prior to that, when he was around, I was paying attention to him, and a lot of people were. He was just, you know, you just kind of, your eyes were drawn to him because he could kind of, in his own way, be like a Tiger Woods of that day, of that era. He could do things that other people couldn't.
I know that he could be, for lack of a better term, a real pain in the arse to play with and against in a Ryder Cup situation. You experienced that firsthand in 91.
Yeah.
But what was he like to play with in a championship situation? Was it a completely different thing? I mean, I can't imagine the gamesmanship was going on.
No, I don't remember anything other than what, you know, I don't even remember what he was doing. And I'm sure he wasn't paying attention to what we were doing, but obviously, we were in position to have a high finish, and, you know, who knows how high at that time when you tee off. But he was, you know, Sevy, and I'm sure it was a twosome. I'm sure I was interested. But he wasn't playing as well as Chip. And then, you know, once Chip really got going, it was on the backside, somewhere around the 13th or the 14th hole. And Sevy, at that point in time, I mean, I never expected this, but he came over to Chip and he said, Chip, you know, I don't know if he said I'm out of it, but he was acknowledging that he did not have a chance to win. And he wanted to let Chip know that whatever Chip needed to do, he said, do whatever you need to do. Don't worry about me. I remember that. I was like, wow, that's kind of generous.
That was a really, really cool thing and something that, you know, I think everybody just remembers the Seve of the Ryder Cups and the gamesmanship and everything. And that's why I wanted to ask that question. I wanted to know if Seve had said something to get out of the way, because Chip's round, especially as you mentioned, the back nine on Sunday, he shot 65, but you guys had a chance at a 29 on that Sunday.
Well, yeah, and following up, you know, regarding Seve, I don't remember what we scored on 16 or 17. But I know, let's see, I think we were 5 under par on the backside at that time. Is that right?
Yeah.
So we're 5 under par, and between 17 green and 18 tee, it feels like there's about 100-yard private walk between a wheat field type thing, and maybe even a little bit longer. And I remember Seve was like in Chip's face, and he said to him, "Chip, you need one more. You can do it. You can do it. You need one more. You can do it." He kept telling that, and I feel goosebumps right now, because I was like, holy cow, you know, strangely enough, I think my ego was like, I was thinking, well, I know more about Chip's game than Seve does, but when it comes out of Seve's mouth, all you can do is just back up, because that's experiential knowledge, and Chip just piped it off of 18 tee. I think we had a 4-iron. In about 5 feet, it was just covering the flag the whole way, and I think I don't know that that would have happened without Seve's encouragement.
Very interesting, Woods. You have a psychology degree from North Carolina, and the best psychology lesson you ever got was from Seve Ballesteros talking to your guy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was like, just get out of the way, and that's all I did. And fortunately for us, I think maybe Chip probably hit his 4-iron back then, maybe 205 yards or something like that. And we probably had something like 218 yards to the hole, meaning it's like a perfect 4 in that circumstance, because
adrenaline.
You know, the adrenaline's flowing, and he's going to get those 10 extra yards, and he did.
Fantastic. One more thing about 86 before we move into today. You got to be on the bag with Chip for a number of cool things, major championships, Ryder Cups. Where did this day rank as you look back?
Well, it's almost like first place, because I guess I had found my home, so to speak. I knew that I could do this, and felt like that upon reflection, you know, I felt like I was competent enough to caddy for somebody who's ready to win a major and play a role in that. And then I think, you know, seeing Chip just blossom like that in a very big stage with a guy like Seve Ballesteros being like a competitor right in the group. So I think that was probably the first time that, you know, things just lined up for us to where, you know, I felt like anything was possible, either for us as a team or for me as an individual caddy.
He's Sam Burns' caddy. That's David Woosley. More from him and the preparation that he and Sam have in store for next week's U.S. Open coming later. But when we return from the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, Ron Green Jr. takes dead aim at last week, this week, and next week. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Joining us now, Ron Green Jr. from the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Ron, before we get started talking golf, I saw you tweet something out the other day, and I was unaware of this, that it was a sad, sad day in Carolina sports. Dwight Clark passed the other day, and I didn't realize that you knew him, and it was a very interesting story. Can you share that real quick?
Yeah, he grew up on the road behind me. I lived in Windsor Park years and years ago, and Dwight lived one street behind us and down a little bit, but he was a year younger than me in school. And anyway, I played 1 year of football, or maybe more properly, I was on the football team for 1 year. I didn't play much. I was a lineman, and that didn't quite suit me. But anyway, Dwight and I would ride to practice over to Midwood Park to play for the Plaza Presbyterian Wildcats. I think I'm correct. It was the first year Dwight played football and was just getting started. And I was one and done. Dwight stayed on playing and did pretty well for himself.
Yeah, we were trying to think the other day, you have to rank that catch against the Cowboys. That's easily a top five, top ten catch in the history of the NFL, don't you think, in terms of fame?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you think of, if you were going to put together a list of iconic plays like the Immaculate Reception and couple other things, that's certainly one of them. I mean, it's one of the first things come to my mind. Now, having known him for years and everything, it probably meant a little more to those of us around here, but that's right there. If it's not at the top of the list, it's near it.
You know, one of the most incredible stats I heard about him, and we'll get into golf eventually, is that his senior year at Clemson, he caught 13 passes and yet made himself into a top-flight all-pro NFL wide receiver.
If I'm not mistaken, I think Bill Washington saw him because they were working out Steve Fuller, and they needed somebody to catch passes for him. And Dwight was the guy, as I recall. And then, you know, he was never the fastest. I mean, he's big, but never the biggest. But he was just knew how to play. And, you know, friends of mine who stayed close to him through the years, and, you know, they sort of stayed. I moved to a different school, and they all stayed together for years. And, you know, they said he was sort of their quarterback. I mean, he had that way about him, sort of that leadership kind of guy, and just really likable. And just, you know, just a nice, nice person, just terribly sad. The way his life ended with that. But you could see in the stories about some of the 49ers going back out to visit him at the end and everything, what he meant to people. And I remember doing a story for the Observer here years ago. We got together, and he went and got the football. He had the football in his closet that he had for the catch.
No kidding.
And, it was and that was pretty cool. Just, you know, he stayed Dwight through it all.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. You were at Memorial the first part of last week, and it's something that happened during the first part of last week that I wanted to ask you about first, and that is they always have an honoree for the Memorial every year, and this year it was Hale Irwin. And I got to thinking and looking at the stats on Hale Irwin. He's sort of a forgotten guy, similar to me in the way that Billy Casper is forgotten in the era of the Big Three in the 60s and 70s. Hale Irwin won 20 times on the PGA Tour, won 3 United States Open, and had an amazing champion/senior tour career, yet you just don't hear him mentioned all that often as one of the greatest of all time, despite the fact that he's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, Jack sort of put the spotlight back on him some with that ceremony at Muirfield Village, but you're right, I mean, he was a classic U.S. Open player. I mean, he could hit it straight, he was tough. You know, and I don't know in the U.S. Open that you have to be the greatest putter in the world. You don't usually have to putt great to win the U.S. Open, but you have to be a good putter, and I think he was that. And, he had the blessing of athleticism and good health through the years. I mean, it allowed him to just keep playing and winning, much like Bernhard Langer now, longer than most guys would do it. He was an exceptional player.
Speaking of the Memorial, Bryson DeChambeau steps into the winner's circle, and this is a kid, he has a unique style, a unique way of doing things. He had a chance to win down at Valspar, made a huge mental mistake on the weekend on the second or third hole that cost him that tournament. He was in the running at Bay Hill until Rory went crazy. Now a win at Jack's Place. Where do you have him on your list of the up-and-coming young players on the PGA Tour?
Well, I have him on the Ryder Cup team right now. That's for one thing. I mean, he's 8th in points right now. He'd be the last of the automatic qualifiers at this point anyway. But I have no doubt that Bryson DeChambeau is going to be on the Ryder Cup team this year. And it wouldn't shock me if he ends up getting paired with Tiger Woods, because I also think Tiger's going to be on the Ryder Cup team. But I just think he does it differently than everybody else. And, I mean, he's sort of got that Big Bang Theory sort of personality with all the science and formulas and theories and physics and all that. And, you know, he was saying at the Memorial after he won, he said, I know a lot of people sort of roll their eyes and think it's really weird, but he said it's sort of a comfort thing then too. It reconfirms that when it comes time to just hit the ball, that he's got everything covered. And, you know, some guys don't want all that much information. He obviously wants as much as he can. And, you know, I mean, he's got the one-length clubs and all that. It may not work for everybody, but it works for him. And, I mean, go back and look at his pedigree. I mean, this is not unexpected, really. I mean, he's been a very good player, and we've sort of seen this coming.
Yeah, I mean, he won a U.S. amateur. He won an NCAA title. The talent's been there for a long time. You know, is he a pleasant enough person as far as you dealing with him? You know, I almost get the idea that he might be kind of standoffish in a way, but I haven't heard any stories about him. Is he easy to deal with?
I think he's okay. I mean, they're all easy to deal with when they win a big tournament, I think. But I think, yeah, he's all right. I think, you know, he's like a lot of them. Let them get their work done. They all have their routines and schedules. But, no, he's been accommodating, and I'll give him credit for this. He's been very patient trying to explain his style, his theories and all that stuff, and his sort of idiosyncrasies to people. Because every town he goes in, if he's in contention, you know, it's a fresh story that week for that group. So he's been very good at talking about it. You know, I think he's probably got it boiled down to, here are my talking points. But, yeah, I think he's an interesting character to have out there.
Is he a good enough putter to win a U.S. Open?
Well, I mean, he's good enough to win. I mean, Brooks Koepka won last year. Is he a great putter? Probably not, but... you know, I mean, Dustin Johnson's a very good putter, won the U.S. Open, but he's not the greatest putter. And then you say that, then Jordan Spieth, until recently, has been the best putter, and he wins. So, I mean, I think he could win. I think, you know, more than any other big tournament, the U.S. Open is about eliminating the big mistake, the big, you know, making the triple or something, that because it's so hard to get those strokes back. You know, you almost play defense a lot of times in a classic U.S. Open, which... we haven't had that many classic U.S. Opens recently, but I think getting to Shinnecock, if we get the weather we're supposed to get, you know, with temperatures only about 70 degrees and enough breeze to play with them some next week, I think, you know, it's going to be about keeping it in front of you and not getting it off those fairways, because if you get off the fairways, you can make 100 there in a hurry. And I think he's good at that.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. Thank you for bringing up Jordan Spieth. It seems like every year we have a 2 or 3 month period where we sort of scratch our head and go, Jordan Spieth looks like a lost soul. And then all of a sudden something happens and he's able to turn it on. And last year he went on to win, you know, dramatically in Hartford and won the Open Championship. But Ron, he just looks absolutely bewildered right now on the golf course.
And frustrated. I think, you know, I mean, doesn't matter how good you are, when you keep putting the work in and not getting the results. And at one point he said, you know, maybe I was working on the wrong things. I put all this time into it and I maybe realized it wasn't what I need to be working on. I think that adds to the frustration. I mean, long-term, big picture, I'm not the least bit worried about Jordan Spieth. But at the moment, yeah, I mean, he needs to see some go in. I mean, nothing gets you putting better. It sounds silly, but nothing gets you putting better than to see a few go in, because you get so used to seeing them slide by, or just, you know, you hit the ball and you look up and you're like, it's still got 10 feet going on, that doesn't have a chance. I mean, that's just, that wears you down. But, you know, I mean, it's Rory McIlroy was talking last week about, somebody said, what is it about putting? He goes, you can sort of control the long game better, but there's just so many factors with putting, the grass, the weather, the wind, speed, how you're striking. He goes, you know, you can put a robot down there at 8 feet with the same putt 100 times, and it's not going to make 100 in a row. Things happen. And I think, you know, that's part of golf. And I think it really, guys, players, you know, they lose a little confidence. I mean, look at Tiger. I mean, he was leading the tour in strokes gained putting earlier this year. And now suddenly, you know, every four-footer is a little bit of hold your breath right now. Do I think that's going to last? No, but I think it's a reality right now. And I think Jordan's going through some of that.
Yeah, thanks for bringing up Tiger and his putting. I saw an interesting quote last week. Ball striking, Tiger looks like Tiger 2000. Putting-wise, Tiger looks like Tiger can't get out of bed. This is the second consecutive start, the weekend at the TPC, and then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, for the most part on Sunday, where the ball striking was as on point as we've seen it, you know, maybe since 2012, 2013 with Tiger Woods. But it's like you said, it's almost like the gods gave him a finite number of 6 footers under pressure that he was going to make, and he's used them all up, because we just keep expecting him to hit that next gear for those, when he's climbing the leaderboard. He had the lead on Sunday, that those putts are going to fall every time like they used to, and they're not falling at all.
No, not right now. I mean, you see him missing ones you've never expected him to miss. you know, you could get into mechanics and setup and all that. But I got to believe there's a little bit of a confidence thing. I mean, you go back to Wells Fargo. He was never comfortable on the greens at Quail Hollow. And other than, you know, he had some stretches there, the players, it's become, you know, as the other part has gotten tighter, this has gotten looser. And it's just almost like reverse form for him over the past 2 or 3 months.
Somebody who looks fantastic winning in Fort Worth and making that place look like the easiest course on planet Earth, which it is not. And then he looked great this last week. You would not, I imagine we wouldn't have to go too far down on your favorites list for the U.S. Open to get to the name Justin Rose.
When I put my favorites list together for our magazine Monday morning, you wouldn't have to go down at all to find it. You would start there. I mean, I just think he's built for U.S. Opens. I say that. I think he's missed the cut in the last two. But I would say Aaron Hills is a bit of a wild card. But,
right.
There. But I just think Justin Rose is, I mean, you go back to the late last year, what it was, a 10 straight top 10 finishes to end the year. I mean, he's come in, played pretty well this year, what he did at Fort Worth there. I just think he's one of those guys, if you're going to make the U.S. Open list, I think he's right at the top of most, if not every list. I mean, I think Ricky Fowler's one of those guys. I think Jason Day gives you some reason to think he could do it. I think, Justin Thomas, Dustin Johnson, those guys, the usual suspects, although, you know, Spieth is the guy we're sort of looking at right now, wondering what's going to happen.
Get you out of here with a couple here. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. TPC Southwind in Memphis is where they're playing the FedEx St. Jude this week. It becomes a World Golf Championship next year. I don't know where it's going to fall on the schedule. I know some players like to play going into U.S. Open. They just like the feel of continuing to play. But, my gosh, this is one of those courses. This is not an easy course. This is a grind. And I would think that you wouldn't want to have the hard mental grind 2 weeks in a row.
Well, I think the field suggests that most players agree with you. You deal with the heat there and you deal with the hard golf course. I mean, I think they have something like 27 players who are in the U.S. Open field next week are playing Memphis. There's some big guys, Dustin Johnson, there's Phil's there. I mean, Daniel Berger's won two in a row there. I think Kisner's playing there, some guys. But more than not are skipping because they give themselves a week to sort of get ready for what they got coming up at Shinnecock. It'll be interesting next year. I think this will, what will be the, I think, what are they going to call it? I think the WGC FedEx Championship or something. It's going to be after the last major championship, after the Open. It's going to be the big event between the Open and the start of the FedEx Cup playoffs. So it will be interesting to see if my scheduling calendar is right. I think it's going to be toward the last weekend in July, which is always a balmy time in Memphis.
And finally, the U.S. Women's Open, hats off to the crew, the grounds crew at Shoal Creek and the USGA for getting that thing completed on time. I wouldn't have bet any amount of money that they could have pulled that off last week. But it got really interesting on Sunday with Arya Chichanagarn blowing a 7-shot lead with 9 holes to go. It was very reminiscent of Palmer at Olympic Club in, what was it, 66 or 67. Now, she wound up winning first of the aggregate 2-hole playoffs. And my question is about that. How did you think that playoff went? How did you like seeing it for the first time in a USGA event?
Well, I mean, I think it was funny. It was sort of clouded or colored by the fact that Chichanagarn had that big lead and then it was gone. And I mean, you're sort of like, oh my gosh. Yeah. You, for those of us who remember Olympic Club and all and Palmer and all that, you're starting to think about that, and then you feel, gosh, she had it right there. Now, how must she be feeling? I mean, I'm okay with the 2-hole playoff. I think, you know, obviously they ended up, I guess, going more, but it's okay. I think we are at a place in time where we want a resolution on Sunday. We never thought they were going to get there given the weather forecast and then what happened through the early part of the week, but however they did it, and congratulations to them, they got it done. And, you know, that's a heck of a golf course. A second golf course Jack Nicklaus designed. He's gone back and massaged it and made some changes. But that is a big-time golf course that could host about whatever they wanted.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And up next, part two of our conversation this week with Sam Burns' caddy, David Woosley. Woos takes dead aim at where Sam's career progression is and their preparation for next week's United States Open Championship, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Part two of our conversation now with Sam Burns' caddy, David Woosley. All right, let's move into the now. I mentioned Sam. He's one of the real bright young talents out there. We hadn't spoken in about a month, I guess, since Quail. Where are we now with his week-to-week eligibility on the PGA Tour? Because I know that he was real close to getting temporary status last time we talked.
Well, we're completely out. In other words, Memorial,
going into Memorial and Colonial, by the way, he had already used his 7 starts.
Okay.
But he got a special invite at Colonial. I don't know what category that was. And then he was already going to be in Memorial because he had won the Jack Nicklaus Award as a sophomore last year at LSU. He was selected the award winner for the best player in college golf. So, and that's a Jack Nicklaus Award. And along with that goes a start at the Memorial. So not only are we completely out, if you looked at our last 3 events, which was a web.com event, Colonial and Memorial, we missed all 3 cuts. Actually, we made the cut at Memorial, but we missed the
Saturday cut. Yeah,
shot a bundle, and of course, there's a story behind that. The story being that made a slight swing change about a month ago, and so it's just kind of the way it went for us. But I certainly believe in the things that he's working on, and that he and his coach are working on, and that bore fruit this past Monday. He shot 15 under and won the local qualifying in Memphis. They had a great field, in fact, and he won by 5 shots. And the closest behind him was Steve Stricker. So, I mean, he's working on the right stuff, and we're both excited to get up there. All I'm going to be preaching to him is, you know, fairways and greens and no big numbers, you know. He's good enough to have a good finish up there, but you've got to just be patient and play smart.
Yeah, we'll get to the sectionals here in a second because that was quite a performance. But let me see if I have this right. You guys do have 1 web.com win this year and a 2nd place finish on the web.com. So for all intents and purposes, Sam's card is basically sewn up going that route for next year. Now, at this point, do you chase Monday qualifiers, or do you continue to play regularly out there on web.com in hopes of trying to better your placement at the end of the year?
Well, maybe you have more knowledge than we do, but my understanding is it's not fully sewn up. In other words, I think we have 160,000 somewhat, and I think what they're projecting this year is like 170,000 on the web. And so we're not chasing any kind of Monday qualifiers. As a matter of fact, I've already booked a flight to Wichita, Kansas. So it'll be U.S. Open, and then there's a tournament in Wichita, Kansas, a web event. And then the following week, I think, is in Illinois, another web event. So we're playing 3 in a row. The second 2 will be web events. Having said that, you know, if he does have a good tournament this week, and I guess they have double points or triple points. You know,
right.
There are possibilities, but based on the fact that we missed the last 3 cuts and we still have this sort of a new swing, you know, anything can happen, including missing the cut. Or I think we could even finish. I feel like we could finish like top 30. I mean, 30th, something like that would be our hoped for goal, maybe. I don't know.
David Woosley, Sam Burns caddy, is our guest taking dead aim. Were you guys exempt from regional and got to go straight to sectional qualifying?
Yeah, I guess that's on maybe world ranking or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I was figuring, that was probably what that was done in. And sectionals is about as old school USGA as it gets. I mean, you got 2 rounds in 1 day. It's a total grind. You were at Memphis. 117 players for 11 spots available. Now, to give a little history, and I don't know if you knew this, I looked it up. A couple of years ago, Sam, who was then at LSU, made it at this exact site into the U.S. Open through a playoff. This year, you already mentioned, it was stupid. 9 under in the morning, 6 under in the afternoon, medalist by 5 shots. You guys ripped it up.
Yeah, and he was in full form. And I think we've, even the cuts that we've missed, on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, he was playing good golf. And then, you know, but you can't simulate a swing change. You can't simulate what you're doing on a practice range or in a practice round. You got to take it to the tournament rounds. And so that's what he's working through. And I think once we got through Memorial and the way that ended, I think Sam, you know, and both Sam and I were looking at this as, okay, now we're going back to the web.com, and we need to take care of business out there, and take care of business meaning, you know, move as high up that list as we can and also perfect what he's working on, because he's obviously working on the right stuff.
Yeah, you mentioned in earlier, and I joked with you about your psychology. He shot 81 on Saturday at Jack's Place. 2 days later, he's medalist at sectionals, qualifying for the U.S. Open. I mean, I realize you're not a practicing psychologist with your shingle on the door, but how do you get him mentally from slamming his trunk with an 81 on Saturday, had to be shaking his head, to where he does that 2 days later, Woos?
Well, I talked to his coach, that evening, and I told his coach, his name is Brad Pullen, excellent swing coach from Louisiana, and I described our last month, you know, prior to and including the Memorial Tournament, as what I would call frantic golf. In other words, he's frantically trying to hit as many shots as he can, play as many holes as he can from sun up to sundown to try to get this, what he's working on, to try and perfect that before trying to compete with it. And then when he's competing, he's just trying too darn hard. And I was telling, you know, Brad Pullen that, you know, you just can't speed up time, and you, if you do, it feels like you're going backwards. And so I would have been really surprised had he not played significantly better immediately after finishing at the Memorial, because I think he could just completely relax and know where I'm going to be at. I'm going to be on the web. I wouldn't have predicted the shooting 15 under, though, but he obviously got the putts rolling and that sort of thing, and he actually said, you know, driving over from the first tournament site to the second tournament site for the 36-hole qualifier, I think he said something like, "I just shot 19 strokes better than our last professional round." Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Woos, how important is it getting your man mentally ready to compete at Shinnecock that this is not his first U.S. Open?
Yeah, well, you know, it makes me think back to the Barbasol when I went down there and saw him for the first time and practiced with him, you know, I think 4 days before the tournament. And I think the day before the tournament, I told Sam, I said, "Sam, if there was a switch in your head that could make you see what's going on around you, it's just another college tournament, I would flip that switch for sure, because you're playing well enough right now to play at a really high level." And obviously, I think we finished sixth there. I don't know if that was helpful or not, but I'm going to be just talking about what, you know, the top of the line players are talking about going into majors, which is, you know, we got to be hitting fairways, we got to be hitting greens, and we can't have any big numbers. In other words, when you miss a fairway, just get it back in the fairway and try to make a par, but you're going to make a bogey, stuff like that. So, but again, you can't speed up time. I think he knows that what he's working on is really good. Part of the 81 that we shot is we were pulling clubs that were way too aggressive, and we've been doing that a lot recently. And I'm just going to encourage him to, you know, just have some really solid targets and be committed to those targets and not pull out clubs that where you've got a smaller percentage of being successful with those clubs.
Is a lot of where he is right now believing that he belongs on the PGA Tour? Is there a mindset, you know, if you're in college, you feel like, okay, am I good enough to be on the web.com? And then when you're on the web.com, is there another step you have to take that, hey, you know, I'm really good enough to be out here? Is that kind of where he is now, or is that not an issue?
I think it's both. I think it's kind of not an issue because I think that, you know, deeply inside of him, I think he's ready for this, and I think he knows that he's ready for this. The experience playing with Tiger Woods on Sunday at the Honda and finishing I don't know, we finished eighth, but, you know, he played better than, scored better than Tiger that day, and he obviously was comfortable when we were playing in that kind of a big environment. So I think he has that sort of knowledge, but you don't fully know it until you really know it, and that's when you perform, you know, in majors, you know, with the big boys, and that's around the corner. I don't know if it's around the corner this upcoming week or it's going to be next year, but I think, you know, he's crossed these so-called barriers every step of the way from junior golf up until now, and including now, you know. I mean, he shot, what, he shoot 6-under the backside at Savannah on Sunday to win that Webb event by one shot. And like I said, playing with Tiger, I think he was in third place on the 16th tee at Tampa. So you even have a chance to win from that position. And, of course, what happened, you know, made some mistakes coming in. But all of this stuff is just part of the learning process. Another thing that I will encourage him, and I think everybody else will see it, you know, including his swing coach, is, you know, we can't lose here at Shinnecock. All we're going to do is win here, because at the least we're going to miss a cut and we're going to learn a lot. Either way, we're going to learn a lot. And so hopefully we'll just try to normalize this thing and play around it off.
Sam Burns' caddy is David Woosley. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here with these two quick ones. You mentioned as this show airs, you're up there now. It's Saturday, and you guys are going out on a practice round. What is your schedule or your planned schedule for Sam leading into round one?
Well, he talked about this, and he was last week, especially reflecting on our poor round on, you know, our 81. Having a plan. He likes having a plan and to plan out on his holes and having, you know, knowing what he's going to do. And so that's what we're going to do. And we're going to have a plan. I told him I've never really done that, and the players I've worked for have never really done that. And my point is, you know, that the plan, if you have a plan, it has to have flexibility in it, because, you know, who knows what the conditions are going to be, the pin positions and that kind of thing. So we need to respond to whatever comes our way, but we're going to be working on a solid plan. So he knows what he's going to do on the first tee, you know, and the whole 18 holes. That's what's going to happen.
Do you see you guys playing at some sort of golf on that golf course every day leading up to it, or do you think you'll take a day off?
I would imagine we're going to play 18 Saturday, 18 Sunday. Let me see. I would imagine, I don't know what's going to happen Monday, but we'll probably play 9 holes on Tuesday, and, you know, like the front 9 and then practice on Tuesday and then the back 9 and practice on Wednesday, that kind of thing, because we've got plenty of time to get prepared for this course. And you do need rest going into majors. That's what veterans know, and they schedule that in as well. And I think Sam knows that too. You know, it's not the physical stuff, it's the mental stuff that catches up to you. If you're playing well, if you have a chance to win in a major, it's the mental stuff that breaks down, not the physical.
And one last thing. In your opinion, and I love this kid's game, so many people do, I told you this when you were at Quail, is Sam the kind of guy that you look at and you look at his tools and you say, this is the kind of guy that can win a U.S. Open? Or do you feel his game at this time may be better suited for another major?
Well, I don't know about if I separate it that way, but what I have said to family and friends about the player that I'm working for, and I've been saying it for months, is I just can't see Sam not being anything but great. And to me, a great player wins majors. And that's what I see for Sam in the future. And he has all the tools. He has an amazing work ethic. His level of grit is off the charts, and his instincts when he's under the gun is to get right after it. And so, and he's just a really hard-nosed competitor. He wants to be in the arena. He talks about being top 5, being number 1 in the world, as if it's a reality. And so it's just really exciting to be a part of that. I don't know what's going to happen this week. I'd be surprised. Obviously, I feel like we're going to get our card next, you know, for next year. And I can see great things for him sooner rather than later.
There's a lot for all of us on the golf course and in life that can be taken from that conversation. Next week at the U.S. Open, he'll be on the bag for young Sam Burns. In 1986, he was on the bag for Chip Beck when he finished second at Shinnecock Hills. That's caddy David Woosley. I'd also like to thank Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for his time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Hey, weather-wise, should be a pretty good weekend to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt our souls and break our hearts. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.